I want to welcome you all to another session of Kentucky Live. This is the fourth presentation in our fifth series of talks on Kentucky Live, Southern Culture at its Best, sponsored by the Friends of WKU Libraries. And as you know, my name is Brian Coots, and as head of the Department of Library Public Services at WKU, I coordinate this series with my colleague Peggy Wright, with help from Hai Wong Wan back in the air, shooting pictures and making us all famous. Thanks to Brian Carson, our reference coordinator, and our technical specialist tonight is David Runner. We couldn't do the presentation without him. Our speaker tonight received her MA and her EDS from WKU for her groundbreaking research on Asiatic cholera in Kentucky, 1832 to 1872. In 1975, she joined the faculty of the Department of Library Special Collections, where she's currently a professor and specialist in Kentucky history. Since she's become one of WKU's most prolific authors. Her early research focused on the 19th century medical history in Kentucky and resulted in two books, David Wendell Yandell, Physician of Old Kentucky, and Luke Pryor Blackburn, Physician, Governor, Reformer. In the 1980s, she began studying the role of the USO and visited 16 states and several foreign countries, and this resulted in a whole series of articles with fascinating titles like Soldiers in Grease Paint, Camp Shows, and the Foxhole Circuit. She also collaborated with Carol Crow Carrico and Michael Morris to publish Bowling Green, A Pictorial History, which has gone through several editions. In the 1990s, she began research while accompanying her husband on the English women in colonial South Africa, which is an ongoing project, and she found time to co-author the bicentennial history of Bowling Green in Warren County. And in 2006, she co-wrote the centennial history of WKU, which has been a big seller for the university. She's here tonight to talk about her most recent publication, and the one she confesses was one of the most difficult to write, called Healing Kentucky, Medicine in the Bluegrass State. It's a topic she knows well because it's in the family blood, so to speak. Her husband, daughter, and son-in-law are all physicians. Welcome, Nancy Baird.
Thank you. Do you remember Dick and Jane in the first grade? Run, Dick, run! See Spot, run! Oh, oh, oh! See Dick and Jane run and play. Unfortunately, a fairly large number of people did not become acquainted with this fun-loving twosome in their primary years. When they tried to sharpen their reading skills as adults, they found these beginner books written for children were not at all interesting to them. Consequently, a few years ago, the Kentucky Humanities Council instituted an ongoing series of booklets written on topics interesting to adults who read at the first through fourth grade levels. Called New Books for New Readers, the series has been a great success, not only among adults learning to read, but also among English as a second language students and in junior and senior high remedial programs. To date, the series is composed of 14 titles addressing such issues as ghosts, history mysteries, Kentucky women, archaeology, the Lewis and Clark expedition, and the United States Constitution. My contribution, Healing Kentucky, is an overview of the history of medicine and healthcare in Kentucky. When the Humanities Council asked me to write the booklet, I readily agreed, thinking it would be a real snap. I talked to my family doctors, my husband, daughter, son-in-law, all of whom are practicing physicians, and ask what should be my underlying message. And all agreed it should be prevention. My instructions from the Humanities Council indicated that the booklet should cover two centuries of healthcare in Kentucky in about 80 pages. Friends who teach in the primary grades and in remedial reading programs suggested that I use no words bigger than three syllables. Knowing that both medicine and Kentucky are three syllables, and that such basic words as inoculation, quarantine, respiratory, etc., were more than three, I began to realize this was not going to be such an easy project. It's turned out to be the hardest writing I've ever done, and perhaps the most rewarding. So, have you ever thought about everyday life and health experienced by our ancestors? If so, you may question how many of them lived long enough to produce and raise another generation. Historians believe that prior to the 19th century, less than half of all pregnancies ended in the birth of a healthy child. Statistics are not available for those years, but from reading letters and diaries of the era, one becomes very conscious of the abundance of miscarriages, stillbirths, and infant deaths. One also rapidly learns that until the 19th century, childbirth was the number one killer of women due to hemorrhaging, childbed fever, and other problems then untreatable. Children who survived birth faced a multitude of dangers. How did a babe receive nourishment if its mother had died or had an insufficient milk supply? Unfortunately, there was no Similac or Enfamil or Gerber's baby food. One cannot help but wonder how many 19th century babies and small children starved or were so weakened by malnutrition that they succumbed to a relatively mild disease. And what about childhood diseases? Next time you visit Louisville's Cave Hill Cemetery, go through the children's section near the duck pond and read the heartbreaking acres of headstones. Our darling died of tetanus, died of typhoid, died of diphtheria, or just died. One of the most heartbreaking statements I think I've ever read was in a letter that a Bowling Green woman wrote in the 1850s, in which she commented that she, like many of her contemporaries, was afraid to let herself love her little baby, lest it die and break her heart. And what about the era of drinking water? It undoubtedly caused more deaths than all other maladies combined. From the beginning of time, humanity obtained water for drinking, cooking, and bathing, if indeed they ever bathed, from shallow wells that frequently received washings containing animal and human waste. And I hate to be indelicate, but I saw this not too long ago, and it kind of proves my point. Somebody indicated, figured it out, that in 1 8-hour day, 1,000 horses deposited 500 gallons of urine and more than a ton of solid waste in the streets of American and European cities. So just imagine the aroma in Louisville, Bowling Green, or elsewhere from this daily contribution. In an era when virtually all transportation involved horses and mules. Consequently, typhoid, dysentery, the summer complaint, which was a good catch-all for everything, and numerous undiagnosed enteric maladies claimed large annual tolls. In the 1850s, as a convenience rather than a matter of health, Louisville began to pump water from the Ohio River to homes and businesses in the oldest section of town. Bowling Green began to do likewise after the Civil War, and undoubtedly, this effort protected a few, but sewer systems and water treatment plants, as we know them, are relatively recent. Bowling Green's fine homes, built at the turn of the century on Upper Chestnut, State, and College Streets, bragged that they had modern systems that dumped household wastes into the town's natural sewer system, the caves under their homes. Unfortunately, what they didn't know was through those caves also ran the streams that fed their wells and cisterns. The WPA built this town's first sewers in the late 1930s. But until the late 1960s, the area south of 14th Street and east of the bypass did not have sewers. And probably today, much of Warren County still depends on wells, cisterns, and septic tanks. Well, if you survive birth and the water, the air might get you. Most 19th and early 20th century homes were heated by coal or wood, if indeed they were heated at all. Imagine the soot and smoke that filled the air and their lungs. Imagine also the grime that covered all their furnishings. Think also about the danger of fire to homes and to the people. Although we don't have dependable statistics, historians believe that fire was a major killer of women whose long skirts got too close while they were cooking dinner. And what about flies and bugs that filled the air, hatched in manure, flew through unscreened windows, sat on food, transmitted disease? Well, I could go on and on, but I'm sure you are nauseated sufficiently to be aware that Kentucky was a pretty sick place during the 18th and 19th centuries. The story of healing Kentucky is a brief look at how the quality of life improved and the average life expectancy increased from about 35 to 40 in the mid-19th century to more than 70 by the end of the 20th century. Obviously, the allotted space for my little book did not allow a discussion of every disease and every doctor of note. So for the booklet, I chose those stories that adults would probably find most interesting and could be explained and discussed with a reasonably simple language, and those that stressed prevention. For tonight, I've selected a few that I hope you will find interesting and thought-provoking and make you want to read more about how we have created a healthier Kentucky. Do you know the story of Ephraim McDowell of Danville? He is often called the father of abdominal surgery. In 1809, using his kitchen as an operating room and a young nephew as his only assistant, McDowell removed a 20-pound tumor from the abdomen of 47-year-old Jane Todd Crawford. Lacking any kind of anesthesia, Jane simply lay there, gritting her teeth, and prayed throughout the ordeal. Frankly, I hope she passed out with the first slash of the knife. What is unbelievable is that she survived. 3 weeks after this history-making surgery, the hardy Mrs. Crawford rode her horse 60 miles back to her home and lived another 33 years. Today, the statue of Ephraim McDowell stands in the U.S. Capitol building. Frankly, I think the one who ought to stand under the dome of our national capitol ought to be the unbelievably brave and exceedingly lucky Mrs. Crawford. Abdominal surgery, indeed most surgery, was seldomly performed during the early 19th century. Chloroform and other anesthesia was unknown prior to the 1840s. When George Rogers Clark had his leg amputated in 1809, he hired a drum and fife corps to play outside his window and drowned out his screams. Even as late as the Civil War, few physicians had access to anesthesia for their patients, nor did they have antiseptics, or even understand the value of soap and water and basic cleanliness. Civil War doctors probed battle wounds with unwashed fingers. Instruments were merely wiped off on their pant leg, perhaps rinsed with cold water if they got too sticky. Amputation was the answer for most wounds of the extremities. This in color is far more interesting than black and white. For a clean cut was less likely to become infected than a wound filled with foreign matter. The memoirs of many Civil War soldiers tell of seeing mounds of arms and legs piled outside makeshift hospitals. In addition to wounds, thousands of Civil War doctors fell victims to measles, typhoid, smallpox, and other communicable diseases. And without the advantage of quarantine, many soldiers became the victims of several such maladies at the same time. To make matters worse, there was no Red Cross or other professional nursing staff in Civil War hospitals. And in this state, only Louisville and Lexington could boast hospitals, and they were certainly abominable by our standards. Consequently, stables, shops, and breezy tents became makeshift hospitals for the sick and the wounded. Needless to say, it's a wonder anybody survived. Despite the horrors, however, physicians learned a great deal about treating wounds. Years later, when asked about the influence of his Civil War experiences on his career as a physician and professor of surgery at the University of Louisville, David Yandel remarked that the war had been a great, though terrible, school for learning new surgical techniques. And I guess we could say the same thing about World War II and all those fracases we've had since then. But what a way to make progress. Transportation improvements in the 19th century made travel easier and faster, but also moved communicable diseases more rapidly. Prior to the 1920s, for example, Asiatic cholera was unknown to the Western world, for it killed its victims in Asia faster than they could flee westward and spread the disease. However, in the late 1920s, the disease appeared for the first time in Western Europe. And in the spring of 1832, Asiatic cholera made its first appearance in American port cities and began its deadly descent by steamboat down the Ohio River. It struck Louisville that fall and appeared in Maysville and Lexington the following spring. Those fleeing from this insidious malady carried the disease inland, and in the next two summers, Asiatic cholera decimated both rural and urban Kentucky. No one knew its cause. Some believed poisons in the night air caused it. Others blamed eating raw fruits and vegetables, or drinking too many alcoholic drinks, or sin. Somebody even suggested too much sex caused Asiatic cholera. Every doctor had a theory and a favorite remedy, but nothing seemed to explain cholera's rapid spread or why it bypassed some neighborhoods and families and struck everyone in other communities at the same time. In many towns, there were not enough healthy people to care for the sick. Cholera victims died faster than coffins could be made, and mounds of bodies wrapped in bedding accented local cemeteries because there was no one to bury the dead. Of the communities in South Central Kentucky, Russellville was probably the hardest hit. In a three-week period in the summer of 1834, at least one quarter of that town's population died of Asiatic cholera. Those who fled undoubtedly carried the malady to other remote rural areas. Cholera disappeared from the United States in the fall of 1835, returned again in the spring of 1848, and ravaged the U.S. and Kentucky every summer between 1849 and 1854. Undoubtedly, each town and community struck during the epidemic had a hero or two who nursed the ill and buried the dead. Perhaps the best known of these was an Irish vagrant nicknamed King Solomon, who dug hundreds of graves in Lexington during the 1833 epidemic. During and immediately after the cholera epidemics, the state's medical journals carried numerous pages of reports, suppositions, and advice written by physicians who had no understanding of the cause. A few, however, did blame filth and urged towns to be cleaned. A Louisville newspaper suggested that part of that city held so many bad smells as the air could possibly endure, and urged that streets and gutters be cleaned, but no one seemed to associate the water supply with the disease. So when did things begin to get better? When does medical science begin to really heal Kentucky? I think the spark that began to change with the devastating yellow fever epidemic of 1878, sometimes referred to as Yellow Jack or the Saffron Scourge. Yellow fever was a frequent visitor to the West Indies, and every few years it hit towns along the Louisiana, Mississippi, Florida coast, as well as the lower Mississippi. Early antebellum Kentucky may also have suffered from a few cases of yellow fever, but it was not so diagnosed. However, in the summer of 1878, yellow fever arrived in New Orleans earlier than usual, worked its way up the river, and by midsummer devastated Natchez and Memphis. Those who could do so fled by boat and train to Paducah, Louisville, Bowling Green, and other places to the north. and in doing so, they carried the malady with them. For although yellow fever is usually considered a tropical disease, it is spread from person to person by a vector host, a mosquito that is indigenous to much of the United States. In early September of 1878, the Louisville paper carried a report of a couple of children at Hickman, Kentucky, who sold apples to passengers on the Mississippi River steamboats and had died of yellow fever. A few days later, the newspaper carried reports that the disease had felled more residents of Hickman. Most Kentucky physicians denied that yellow fever could hit so far north as Kentucky. Dr. Luke Blackburn of Louisville disagreed. A veteran of numerous yellow fever epidemics in New Orleans, Natchez, and Memphis, Blackburn volunteered his services and went to Hickman to aid his residents. In addition to caring for the sick, he created several temporary hospitals, organized and trained groups of women to serve as nurses, and formed several burial committees. Of the 262 indigenous cases that appeared in the small town of Hickman during a six-week period, half died. The disease also appeared in nearby Fulton, and in Bowling Green, and in Louisville, all of which were transportation centers. Bowling Green, then a town of about 2,500, suffered 50 indigenous cases and 26 deaths. Luckily, frost ended the yellow fever visit before it devastated the town. In 1878, no one knew the cause of this deadly scourge, and wouldn't for another 20 years. Nevertheless, Blackburn, who believed that the spread of the disease had something to do with poisons in the night air, was the hero of the day. That winter, the people of Hickman and Fulton held a big dinner and dance and grand ball in his honor. And the following summer, the state's Democratic Party nominated the hero of Hickman as their candidate for governor. He was easily elected. And once in the governor's mansion, Blackburn began a crusade to clean up the overcrowded and filthy state prison in Frankfort, a reform that rendered him one of the most unpopular governors of this state. However, his deed that made the most important and the most long-lasting effect was to appoint Dr. Joseph McCormick, the hero of the yellow fever epidemic in Bowling Green, to the state Infant Board of Health. Created 5 years earlier, the State Board of Health was then merely an advisory group. It had neither the power nor the budget to be effective. McCormick changed that. He operated the board, rent-free, from his house at the corner of 10th and State Street, where apparently operating a Board of Health became a family affair. His wife served as his secretary and typist, and the family cook addressed and sealed the board's outgoing mail. And the handyman gardener made daily visits to the post office to pick up and deliver the board's mounds of correspondence. For nearly 40 years, McCormick directed the board's activities and pushed the state legislature to provide the board with sufficient power and funds to be effective. Not an easy task among people who then, maybe now, are more interested in politics than health or education. McCormick suggested, and the legislature approved, that every county should form a board of health that would be responsive to the state board and would implement the suggestions and laws the state board initiated. Improving sanitation was at the top of McCormick's list. He believed there was a correlation between dirt and disease, and that preventing disease was easier and cheaper than curing disease. Thus, he began an intense campaign to educate not only the state's doctors, most of whom had never been to medical school and had very little basic knowledge, but he also wished to educate the state's politicians and the general public. McCormick initiated studies of towns with high typhoid rates. believing that polluted surfaces and groundwater was a major cause of disease. He urged towns to pipe water from nearby rivers to area homes. And for those who resided in areas where piped water was impractical, he urged the construction of the sanitary privy. Drawings of this recommended privy appeared in Board of Health reports, published flyers and posters, even state newspapers periodically carried drawings and dimensions. The educational program gradually improved health. Knowing that most of Kentucky's doctors had little or no credible training, McCormick also began a campaign to regulate those who called themselves physicians. Since the early days of the Commonwealth, anyone could call himself a doctor. Attempts from time to time to require a medical education had only met with considerable opposition and seemed only to encourage diploma mills. At first, the board's requirement for a license included an apprenticeship with a practicing physician or a degree from a medical school. McCormick pushed through the state legislature laws that required that all applications for medical licenses be submitted to him, and thus he quickly became acquainted with the credentials, or lack thereof, of every doctor in the state. The early licensing process soon eliminated slick-tongued quacks and traveling medicine men who advertised secret formulas for miraculous cures. Gradually, the requirements were tightened to include a degree from a medical school. At about the same time, native Lovellian Abraham Flexner conducted a survey of the nation's medical schools. And his resulting report, published in 1810, had virtually nothing nice to say about any of this nation's medical schools except Johns Hopkins. Flexner labeled Louisville's 9 medical schools, if you can imagine, as little more than diploma mills. Flexner's report resulted in major changes in schools in both Kentucky and across the nation. At the same time, Kentucky's Board of Health also tightened requirements. And by the 1920s, a medical degree from an accredited medical school was required of all who practiced in Kentucky. This accreditation eventually extended not only to physicians, but also to nurses and other health care professionals. At the same time, state and federal laws were tightened concerning medications and what could be sold, and what medicines could claim. Since the mid-20s, the law has become even more strict regarding testing, introduction, and claim of both over-the-counter and prescription drugs. And if you listen to the ads on TV, you know how they have to claim everything. Realizing the statistics provided valuable information regarding health, McCormick created in 1911 the state's Bureau of Vital Statistics to record and keep birth and death records. He asked the legislature for money to create a research lab, and he hired Dr. Lillian South of Bowling Green to operate it. During her near 40 years with the board, Dr. South traveled widely across the state, studying area problems relating to sanitation, communicable diseases, and potential epidemic outbreaks. During one survey, she even found 3 Kentuckians suffering from leprosy. She prepared bulletins and booklets and spoke to crowds of Kentuckians about how to improve individual and area health. As director of the Board of Health Laboratory, she tested in her lifetime barrels of blood samples for venereal disease and tons of human waste for hookworm. She trained hundreds, perhaps thousands, of laboratory assistants. Under her guidance, the Board of Health Laboratory created more than 12 million doses of vaccines that prevented Kentuckians against a host of maladies. McCormick had a plethora of other ideas on how to improve health in his state and among its people. Utilizing the talents of several friends, he and Smith began intense and effective educational programs. Literature aimed at school children and of the public addressed basic health rules and the cause and spread of disease and the means of preventing them. With the help of a couple of local attorneys, McCormick drafted laws requiring blood tests for marriage licenses, requiring restaurants and school cafeterias to have screens in their windows, and that their food handlers be tested for tuberculosis and other maladies. He insisted, and the legislature passed, laws that specified that victims of certain diseases be quarantined. But the law required that all school children be vaccinated against smallpox, and the list goes on and on. He even served one term in the state legislature to help push through some of his reforms. Joseph McCormick wrote, and the legislature approved, the laws that became the basis for Kentucky's health code. In the early fall of 1918, returning soldiers from Europe introduced a new strain of flu into the United States, and military bases, including Louisville's Camp Zachary Taylor, were hard hit. The disease rapidly traveled to every corner of the state, and like epidemics of old, communities suffered from lack of services and insufficient numbers to care for the ill and bury the dead. Shortly after the epidemic hit the state, McCormick ordered that all of the state schools close and strongly advised the closing of all theaters, churches, and businesses and other places where people congregated. For a period of about 6 weeks, this state virtually shut down on the orders of the state Board of Health. 6 times as many Kentuckians and Americans died during the Spanish flu epidemic as died on the fields of France during World War I. In addition to his work in the Commonwealth, McCormick was also active with the American Medical Association and spoke in nearly every state in the Union, urging that they also adopt laws similar to those he had pushed through the Kentucky legislature. On his retirement in 1920, the board moved its headquarters to Louisville because they didn't have all that free help. And shortly thereafter, Joseph's son Arthur became the head of the State Board of Health and continued his father's crusade. Arthur was equally effective as a healer in and out of Kentucky. An 1896 graduate of Columbia University's School of Medicine, Arthur McCormick had served for nearly 2 decades in the Army's Medical Corps, and in 1915 succeeded William Crawford Gorgas as chief medical officer in the Panama Canal Zone. However, Arthur McCormick is perhaps best remembered in Kentucky for his actions during the Great Flood, actions that proved to many Kentuckians that the Board of Health was a very important and powerful arm of state government. In the early days of January 1937, melting snow and a continuous rainfall forced the Ohio River out of its banks. By the end of the month, Maysville, Louisville, Paducah, and other towns along the Ohio River and many of its tributaries were inundated. As the water rose to unprecedented heights, homes filled with water, marooning fleeing residents to the rooftops, water filled shops, leaving customers without food and other necessities. City utilities shut down, and residents were without drinking water, heat, everything. And the sewers overflowed. As the water began to rise, Dr. Arthur McCormick organized relief groups, set up emergency quarters and hospital facilities in dry schools, churches, and other public buildings. He also sent appeals for help to inland towns, and he even arranged to have the state's breweries and distilleries provide pure bottled water for residents of the flooded towns. Lillian South and the board's laboratory staff prepared vaccines to prevent typhoid and other sanitation diseases and inoculated hundreds of thousands of Kentuckians and others who lived along the Ohio and upper Mississippi. McCormick, South, and the State Board of Health prevented what could have been the 20th century's greatest health disaster. Medicine has come a long way in the last half century. I read somewhere that medicine has made greater progress since World War II than from the beginning of time to World War II. Just think of the amazing changes we've witnessed since the introduction of penicillin during World War II. Today, most anything seems possible except perhaps curing the common cold. Since many of you are post-1950 generation, Let me wind up my presentation with what I think are three of the last half century's most obvious and most amazing advances in healing. The eradication of polio, the advent of plastic surgery, and the creation of the artificial heart. Those of us who grew up during the mid-19th century and the near annual polio epidemics remember the fright and hysteria created every time the word was mentioned. My mother was so scared of the sometimes crippling, occasionally deadly disease that she absolutely ruined our summers. We were not allowed to go swimming, couldn't go to the movies, were never permitted to visit Coney Island or any other place where we might be exposed to polio. No one knew its cause. No one knew how it was spread. No one had a cure. But my mother was determined that we were not going to be polio victims. Also, I grew up in a big city where, for those who contracted polio, several hospitals offered the latest techniques and the best care then medical science. Unfortunately, for many who contracted the disease, this special care was not available. In Bowling Green, for example, the local hospital did not allow black doctors on its staff and did not accept black patients. Dr. Z.K. Jones, probably Warren County's best known and most revered African American of recent times, treated numerous black children who contracted polio. For those who required hospital care, he transported them in his car to Louisville General Hospital, where one ward was designated for the care of black Kentuckians. The March of Dimes helped bring an end to the panic of polio. The crusade began in the 1930s, and its earliest supporters included President Franklin Delano Roosevelt, actor Eddie Cantor, and a host of Hollywood celebrities. By the mid-50s, the March of Dimes had raised hundreds of millions of dollars and created the largest research and rehabilitation network in the history of medicine, and it paid off. In the late 1950s, Jonas Salk introduced an inoculation, and a couple of years later, Albert Sabin announced his oral serum, both means of preventing this frightening disease. And just think about all the other recent advances in preventive medicine. Inoculations now available that have made life easier and undoubtedly prolonged the life of our children. A shot in the arm or elsewhere prevents smallpox, probably history's number one killer. The DPT given to babies that prevents diphtheria, whooping cough, and tetanus, all major killers of children a couple of generations ago. The diagnostic tests for all sorts of debilitating conditions. More recently developed inoculations prevent measles, mumps, various kinds of flu. And now we have an inoculation to prevent cervical cancer. Wow. And think too about the advances in surgery, the amazing techniques developed in reconstructive surgery in recent years. Working through the Children of America organizations, for example, Bowling Green's Dr. Tim Halsey repaired the face of Hilaria, a 10-year-old child from Guatemala who was born with a disfiguring cleft lip and cleft palate. Because her country had neither the facilities nor the technology, the child was brought to Bowling Green to get her face fixed. Imagine her fright. I bet she was even more scared than poor old Jane Todd Crawford had been 200 years earlier. Hilaria had left her family and everything familiar to her in Guatemala, and she spoke no English. During her year or so in Bowling Green, she lived with a loving family, Paula and Joe Trafton, and their children. And during that time, she submitted to numerous surgeries and several dental procedures. She attended school in Bowling Green, played on the school soccer team, and became accustomed to things commonplace to the United States. Everything from vacuum sweepers and hair dryers, computers, gadgets unknown in her part of the world. Imagine the unbelievable tales that she can tell to family and friends about her experiences in Bowling Green, Kentucky. The last chapter of Healing Kentucky concerns what sounds more like science fiction than reality, and perhaps it's a fitting close for a talk on Valentine's Day, the artificial heart, an invention by a Massachusetts company that uses a bit of plastic and metal to pump 2,000 gallons of blood through an adult body every day. The first surgeons to transplant the Evercore heart were two Louisville doctors, Lehman Gray and Robert Dowling, and their patient was Robert Tools from Franklin, Kentucky. Tools had been given about 5 weeks to live with his failing heart. Nevertheless, imagine the courage it must have taken to agree to be the recipient of an artificial organ that had previously only been implanted in a pig. When asked about his willingness to submit to surgery, Tools answered that every day he lived was an exciting adventure, that it was a thrill to wake up every morning to see the sunlight and to see his family and his friends. His operation was a success, and during the many weeks of recovery, Tools enjoyed the company of his family, as well as a visit from the Oak Ridge Boys, who were en route to a performance in Nashville, and he even enjoyed lunches with the mayor of Louisville and the governor of Kentucky. Although Tools' artificial heart apparently worked fine, his kidneys eventually failed, and he died 5 months after surviving the history-making surgery. From an operation on a kitchen table to a procedure that replaces the heart with a man-made plastic and metal gadget, medical science has made unbelievable progress in 200 years. Clean drinking water, properly stored and handled foods, better medications, new surgical techniques, all have prolonged life. Yet, as we live longer, new problems arise. The body's organs give out. Eyesight and hearing grow dim. Joints become stiff. Brains forget. Lifestyles also create problems. Our ancestors plowed fields from dawn to dusk, chopped wood for their fireplaces, and walked miles to school or to visit their nearest neighbors. We sit at desks, drive to work, ride a bus, eat too much. Thus, as medical science finds answers to old problems, new ones arise. Nevertheless, we live longer and better than our ancestors. I did a little counting the other day, and of the 33 deaths listed in the Courier Journal, none were infants. One was a teenager, probably a biker who didn't wear a helmet or maybe forgot to buckle up. Three others were under the age of 60, and all the rest were over 65. Compare that to the 1860 mortality census that indicated that 47% of all the deaths in this state were among children under the ages of 6. Wish I could come back in 100 years and see what medicine is going to do to all us oldsters that forget and everything falls apart. In doing the research for Healing Kentucky, I came across a wonderful piece of advice that a mid-20th century doctor, Louise Cottle of Moorhead, preached for many years to her patients. Certainly, it is part of the answer to long life. And it's good advice that all of us should follow. Dr. Cottle warned her patients that if they wanted to enjoy a long and healthy life, they should eat right, sleep right, don't drink too much, don't smoke, and don't play around when you shouldn't be playing around. Thank you. Thank you for helping me get through the... I kept forgetting to hit this thing.
Questions? I might start with, what's the difference between Asiatic cholera and the other cholera?
The other cholera. Well, the term cholera simply refers to this malady that absolutely cleans out both regions of your alimentary canal. Asiatic is even worse than the regular. So in the 19th century, the term cholera could be used for most anything that caused bad diarrhea, bad vomiting. But it didn't deplete the system quite as badly. It didn't usually cause death, or if it did, not as likely as Asiatic. Asiatic cholera is caused by a particular bacillus, and all those other choleras can be caused by anything that affected the alimentary canal. Does that answer your question?
Yeah.
Some of those gals over here have turned white while I've been talking about all this nasty stuff.
What about pharmacies, Nancy? Were there not remedies recommended that
Well, there was no control until you get almost to the 20th century. So almost every doctor made his own pills and syrups and concoctions. Everyone had a different remedy. The Kentucky Building has a pretty good collection of 19th century medical books. Each one more sickening than the other. And if you go back and read some of their remedies, you really wonder how anybody survived. If they gave you whatever and you survived, obviously it was the medicine. It wasn't the fact that you were too strong for their concoction to kill you. But, you know, the things that they gave were just unbelievable. Now, some of the herbs that were used are sort of kind of the basis of some of our drugs today. But the drugs today are highly controlled in the dosage, all those kinds of things. Until almost the beginning of the 20th century, pharmacy is not controlled. And then, very gradually, pharmacists have to be certified by the state, etc. Medications, that comes in as part of the Pure Food and Drug Act in the early part of the 20th century. All of this comes in together and really snowballs in its effect, life, medicines, etc.
Are all medicines today controlled by big business, or do pharmacies, I remember when our father and our brother were practicing pharmacists, they had to compound their own medication.
I really don't know the answer to that, but I would imagine that it's highly controlled. The businesses are going to advertise, but they have to test. They have to test, double test, triple test before they can advertise. And, you know, all you have to do, you know, get those emails about if you've had this, contact whatever attorney. Everything. Aspirin has problems. I mean, some people are allergic to it. If you're on blood thinners, you don't dare take aspirin because it is a blood thinner. So, you know, every medication has its dangers.
I just never could understand when a physician prescribes a particular medication and then there is a generic.
Well, the generic, as I understand it, I don't have the medical degree, Peggy, as you know, but as I understand it, the generic is essentially or supposed to be the same as the real honest-to-goodness stuff. They just didn't have to spend all the jillions of dollars in research. But I've heard physicians say that generics are not necessarily as good as...
I've heard the same. That's the reason I asked the question.
Were there any medical schools in Bowling Green?
No.
Just Louisville?
Louisville, and of course now we have one in Lexington. But at one time there were 10 medical schools in Louisville. The University of Louisville probably was the best, but all of them were operated by the fellows who taught in the schools. So all the tuition money went into their pockets. So the more students you could get, the better. Until the 20th century, medical schools were in two terms, and each term was 5 weeks. You didn't have to be able to read and write to be admitted to a medical school. That's a 20th century thing. The only thing you had to do to get a degree from a medical school until this side of the turn of the century was to be there a time or two and to pass the exam, the graduation exam. There were no exams in between. And I'm sure that with the hefty price of the graduation that most everybody passed.
Do you know if there was a significant difference between the medical schools and medical training in America versus, let's say, Europe?
Oh, yes. The German schools, the Austrian schools were far better. I think maybe even some of the French. One of Ephraim McDowell's claims is that he had a degree from one of the University of Edinburgh or one of the Scottish universities. As I say, the ones in this country, they were really diploma mills. I mean, that's how we would see it today. Johns Hopkins is really the first one where there's an entrance requirement, where there are tests on through, where they had laboratories. The University of Louisville School didn't have laboratories until
Well, you could take a course in anatomy, but it was separate. Can you imagine? In all probability, the first time any of those physicians ever delivered a baby was when they were out in private practice, or lanced a boil, or anything else. It's unbelievable.
The pioneering woman, I'm trying to remember.
Jane? Todd Crawford?
Mm-hmm. No, not the patient, the woman who was running the laboratories.
Lillian South.
Okay. You said she had a medical degree. How open were the medical schools?
Her father was a physician, and I think he probably stomped and screamed and hollered and got her in. And I can't remember, but I think she went to the Women's College up in Pennsylvania. But she is really different.
Yeah.
There just weren't many women physicians. Right. I mean, after all, women are too talented.
Most of what you said, of course, is focused on allopathic medicine, MDs. Mm-hmm. I know now we have that osteopathic mm-hmm. medical program at Pikeville. Was there much, but there doesn't seem to be much these days in terms of osteopathic medicine in the state. Do you know if there were many osteopathic physicians?
I don't know. But I'm going to sidestep your question, Brian, by saying I'm a doctor's wife. You can't expect me to be in sympathetic with the non-MD. In 19th century, none of them knew anything. So it didn't make any difference whether you'd been to medical school or hadn't, or studied with a doctor, or just got your knowledge out of the sky. Some of them were luckier than others. Sometimes that's still probably so.
One more question.
Yeah.
Did you come across in your research any of the more traditional, not the snake oil salesman,
no.
but sort of the traditional village healer herbs or homeopathic, when you mentioned the allopathic?
Especially in the eastern part of the state, herbs were used more than in this area. And as I say, some of those herbs are the chemical basis. One of the historians, and I know quite well, used to be the librarian at Lloyd Pharmaceutical Library up in Cincinnati. And I was asking him one time about herbs. You go out to the mall and you see all these little herbs that are going to take care of this, that, and the other. And I asked him about them, and he said, the problem is with those, there is no control. So this bottle of herbs and this bottle of the same herbs may not be this same, may not have the same content, etc. And that's part of the problem. Whereas a 5 milligram whatever, this pill, and this pill is all 5 milligram. Medication is highly controlled today. And as I say, we hear those ads on TV about this marvelous medicine. Of course, it will do this to you, and this to you, and this to you, and this to you. And you wonder, merciful heavens.
I'm going to ask you one more question. When I studied Louisiana history, we had the famous Hattacol, which was a great maker of patent medicine. Did we have famous patent medicine makers in Kentucky that you just...
Probably, but I'm not... I can't think of any.
Yeah.
But, if you read papers from the 19th century, they're always advertising something. And for the most part, it's codeine and alcohol. Well, sure, it'd make you feel better.
Yeah.
Of course, when you came to, you still had the same problem. But if you felt better...
Thank you all for coming. On behalf of WKU Live, with a token of our appreciation, Nancy, for blessing us.
Thank you.
We hope you'll join us next Thursday when we'll launch our Faraway Places series with Dr. Aristophanes Cedeno, who directs the Panamanian Studies Program at the University of Louisville, who will be here, and he's director of the Governor's Scholars Program for the state of Kentucky. And he's just been to Panama. He's been sending us some slides to look at, so he'll be here.